Hey everybody, it's Josh Rutledge, your co-host for Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to support us more, please head over to our website, fearscapepodcast.com. There you can click on store and browse some really awesome t-shirts and maybe pick a couple up, or even go to our Patreon page and see how you can support us monthly. We love bringing you awesome content just as much as you like listening to it. Enjoy the show.
The following program is presented for entertainment purposes. WCHQ does not necessarily endorse the ideas presented.
Fearscape is a program that explores the legend and lore around many creepy and scary things. Information is researched and presented in an entertainment fashion and is presented based off of what we found. Legends have a way of changing over time, so...
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Fearscape here on 100.9 FM WCHQ, as well as the Destination Nation Network. Fearscape is your home for all things spooky, paranormal, occult, supernatural, all that goodness. I am Stefan, your host for the evening, joined as always by my co-host, Mr. Josh Rutledge.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah. Got the Barry White action going. We have a really cool episode for you tonight. We're going to be discussing the Allagash abductions, which I believe, where did this happen at?
Maine.
In Maine. Oh, well, that explains with Allagash. That sounds very Maine.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're going to be getting into that. We love our abduction stories. Sorry for the people that got abducted. I don't mean to say it like that. We don't love that you got abducted.
Right.
It sucks. But I do enjoy talking about these stories. I love finding proof into the extraterrestrials. So, but yeah, we're going to be getting into talking to that. And before we get into that, you got some spooky news for us?
I do have some spooky news.
All right, well, let's move right into spooky news.
All right, so this comes to us from Kark.com. It appears to be...
Quark?
K-A-R-K.
Oh, I thought you said Quark, like from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. That would have been really cool. you got to pay in gold pressed platinum.
So it appears to be like maybe a local NBC station, wherever this is located.
Oh, okay.
So, this is in Russellville, Arkansas. So there's a video accompanying it for this story. So if anybody wants to know, just... get on there and look up a clown digging hole.
Clown digging hole. Oh, man. Yeah. All right.
So that kind of sets the stage. So this 18-year-old kid in Russellville, Arkansas, is out driving one night. And he and his friend come across a clown digging on the side of the road. He says around 9:30 p.m. he and his friend decided to go to his favorite spot near a lake and talk about a problem his buddy was going through. Been there, done that.
Yep.
We were just going to talk about things, but it's because of a place to get away. We pulled up down the road and there was a clown just sitting there. Now, the video I watched, and like you can see, this kid took this with his iPhone, and it is just a guy in a clown suit digging a hole in the side of the road. And then he proceeds to, I guess he sees the car, so he proceeds to then walk with the shovel dragging behind him.
Oh, no, no.
Towards the car.
No, I'd be out of there like grease lightning, dude.
The video has had more than 800,000 views. He goes on to say, I'm personally afraid of clowns. Hello, me
same.
Too.
Same.
He can't watch it. I can't watch the new one.
I can watch it, but I watch it because I like being scared, but it scares the tar hooties out of me.
But yeah, apparently there, during Halloween time, during, you know, this kind of time of the year, there's an uptick in clown sightings.
Yes. I remember last year or the year before where it was like nuts.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, it's just, so I guess if you really want to just scare the piss out of people, just dress up as a clown and dig a hole inside the road.
And then drag that and sucker behind you.
You know, so yeah. So that is the that's spooky news.
So I find that interesting for spooky news, but what you said, hey, we've all been there. When we were in high school, we used to say, hey, we had this pact, our group of friends, that we would go, if we ever called and left a message, we would just say, hey, we're going to be there. So, you know, if we, because we all just, you know, had trouble being kids and stuff like that. And there always meant Greenwood Boat Docks here in Louisville, Kentucky. And so we all knew we needed to meet up and be there for each other. Well, one night we get a call from Josh that says, hey, guys, the stuff is going on. It's crazy. If I could get there, I would be there.
I don't even remember what that was about.
I don't either, man. But you couldn't get there. That was the funniest part. And so we were like, well, what are we supposed to do?
Drive around aimlessly.
Well, yeah. Like, so I always remember that as, well, if I could be there, I would be there.
Well, I don't even remember what that was.
Yeah, probably an X or Nathan. I'm just going to say it. I'm just kidding. But no, I wanted to share that because that's immediately what I thought of. Was that I remember that because I had my own phone line. And so I remember I had that, that, and that's not a voicemail, an answering machine message forever and ever. But yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Phone lines. Imagine.
Phone lines.
So
hotline bling, phone line bling. It's a whole different thing. All right, so do you got any creepy ketchup? Because once again, I got nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. I do have some creepy ketchup.
All right, well, let's get into it. Let's get into a little bit of creepy ketchup.
Creepy ketchup. Creepy ketchup. Creepy ketchup. Creepy ketchup. Y'all, it's creepy.
I love that tune. Love that tune. Suck it, Brad.
It's so catchy.
So you got a little something happening.
Yeah, so, you know, I think I shared, I'm pretty sure I shared a couple of weeks ago about my dream with, you know, the alien abduction and all that kind of stuff. I think it was in my kind of intro episode. But so since then, I've had some interesting dreams. And I don't know if, you know, I do have a theory around where some of your dreams come from, if you believe in the multiverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe sometimes that our universe rubs up against other universes in the multiverse, and so you glimpse your counterpart's life.
I absolutely believe that, and it's something that when I was a child, I believed. I didn't believe it as big as a multiverse, but I believed it as a second dimension, where when I was asleep, I was dreaming about my counterpart's life. And when he was asleep, he was dreaming about mine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at the time I was going through some abuse and some things like that. And I thought, man, these are his nightmares, and all the crazy vampire stuff that's happening in his reality are mine. Right.
Right.
You know, that's what I always thought.
Well, yeah. I mean, so it's kind of along the same lines. So a lot of times when I think about, you know, when I have these dreams where I'm in this really kind of, I don't know, off the wall situation, I think, well, maybe I'm just glimpsing me in another universe.
In that, another decision.
Yep. So
another decision's path.
But so the dreams of the last two nights, I'll just kind of summarize. So one was I was a part of a crew on a spacecraft. We had to leave the spacecraft for some reason. I don't remember what. But we were all tethered together like in EV suits going out of the spacecraft to try to catch on to another spacecraft.
So not like Human Centipede tethered together.
No.
So everyone can breathe.
No, but, well, I mean, you're in an EV suit in space. So,
I always think of that movie, what is that? That Mars mission or whatever it was where the guy farts in the EV suit.
Rocket Man.
Rocket Man. That's what it is. I love Rocket Man.
Yeah. I watch my kids. I made my kids watch that and they were so bored. So.
Oh, no.
But anyway, so we're going out to try to catch another spacecraft that's like coming by that we're going to use to get down to the planet. Now, if any of this sounds familiar, it's actually used in a movie. I think it's Mission to Mars. But anyways, so this is all happening. So we get down to the planet, And I find myself in like an alien stronghold, I guess. And I'm like walking around and I accidentally bump into something and I knock it over. And then there's just like this big bellow and this alien with 8 feet that are like big elephant feet.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, four arms and four eyes and two mouths comes like, and he's like, he's huge. I mean, he's probably 15 or 20 feet tall, and he comes walking through the doorway. And I decide to follow him to try to, hopefully he won't find me if I'm behind him, right? Because he's huge. And I see him like ordering all these kind of servants around, telling them to go find the intruder. And I get found by like this dog type creature, and then I wake up. So that was one dream. So then the second dream, this is like maybe a couple nights later. I am a psychic. Intergalactic bounty hunter.
Yes.
I use my psychic abilities to read other bounty hunters and know if they have large bounties so that I can steal those bounties from them. I'm in a room, like in a bar or something, that's full of bounty hunters, and I'm scanning the room trying to find a bounty, and I come across someone who has a bounty on me. Mm. And so then there's an altercation, and I wake up. So
bounty hunter versus bounty hunter.
So number one, if anybody needs some really good fan fiction ideas, yeah, you know, just
flip it into Star Wars, and then you've got Boba Fett versus IG-88 or so, Dengar. Yeah.
So that's kind of my creepy catch-up. I mean, they
man, I some, love dreams, man. Dreams yeah. are definitely weird, and keep bringing them if you've got some, because I just had a dream I was at my old house eating stuff.
I was eating Fruit Loops in my underwear.
Yep. And yeah, all right, so that was Creepy Ketchup.
Creepy Ketchup. Creepy Ketchup. Creepy Ketchup. Creepy Ketchup. Y'all, it's creepy.
All righty, so we are here at Fearscape, and we are going to be talking about Allagash abduction. So, warning to all of our blanket huggers, grab those blankets and hold them tight. Because yep. It's about to be freaky deaky.
Freaky.
Freaky deaky.
All right, what do we got?
All right. So, Allagash Waterway in Maine. All right, so this, we basically have four friends. Actually, there's two brothers who are twin brothers, Jack and Jim. And then their two friends, Chuck and Charlie. Now, I think it's interesting that Chuck is probably short for Charlie. So basically, yeah, they have two friends both named Charlie.
Yeah, essentially.
But
maybe that's why he went with Chuck.
Chuck, yeah.
And we got another guy. His name's Chaz.
So they met back in Massachusetts College of Art. They're artist, and they became friends, and was beginning their careers, and they decided to go camping and fishing on a trip to the Allagash Waterway, which again is up in Maine.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Maine is essentially the Montana of the Northeast.
Yeah, I went to Maine once. I swam in the ocean in July, and I remember that the water was so cold it reversed puberty. So
I didn't have reverse puberty, but I used to spend a lot of summers up north in Michigan, and I swam in Lake Superior in July, and yeah, same thing, massive shrinkage. So
so this all takes place in August 1976.
Man, that's interesting, because the Stanford 3, that yep. happened in 1976 as well.
Well, you think about really all the kind of really big abduction stories, like the fire in the sky guy,
mm-hmm.
the sisters, this story, it's all like in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about, we've seen sightings since then, but most of the, at least what I've been able to uncover, most of the big stories happened in the 70s.
Well, and, you know, some of that could be due to media coverage, yeah. you know, whereas today we laugh at it. And we all, yeah. you know, or, you know, things are just handled differently. Who knows?
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you the last time the news covered a legit abduction case.
Right.
Like, legit in our minds anyways.
and right. took it seriously.
Legitimate in the mainstream.
But yeah, I mean, 76, that was literally the same year as the Stafford Three. I don't know when Fire in the Sky was. I don't remember, but...
I want to say it was like 74, 75.
Yeah, I know it was before these ones, so... Yep. But yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And I'm pretty sure the Stafford Three was pretty close to that date as well. So
yep. So we've got these four gentlemen. They're up in Allagash. They're going to do some camping and some fishing. And so they decided they wanted to ride on Eagle Lake, which I'm not entirely sure where that is, but I'm sure it's a lake in Maine. And
heard it's the main lake.
Well, the eagle has landed. So they're running low on food, and they decided to do some night fishing. So before they left in their canoe, they built an extremely large campfire to be a landmark on shore to help them navigate to their campsite and also provide some light because, again, they're night fishing.
Right.
They're going on the lake. They've been out on the lake for a little bit of time, and they see a light that seemed much brighter than a star. The glowing orb, as it's called, was hovering over the trees a couple of hundred yards away. The object changed colors as it moved back and forth, red, then green, then a yellowish, kind of whitish yellow. The massive object, it says, was estimated to be 80 feet in diameter.
Wow. I mean, it's not a mile wide like Phoenix Lights, but for three guys in the woods, 80 feet is pretty nice.
Three guys in a canoe
on
a lake. I mean...
Hungry, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we all saw Deliverance, okay? That's what happens when three men are on a canoe.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't say here, but I would imagine that the craft made some kind of a banjo music sound.
Right.
So the object slowly moved across the tops of the trees and along the bank, and as it came closer to the four fishermen, Charlie of the group decided, hey, let me signal SOS with my flashlight.
No, yeah, here's a strange object. Yeah. Let's signal it.
Even if it was a helicopter, I still wouldn't have signaled.
No.
So immediately the object silently moved toward the canoe. A guarded curiosity now turned into a frantic dash for the bank. So now they're like paddling as hard as they can, before they're headed towards their campfire. It says a hollow light came from the object, engulfing the men in their canoe.
Interesting, because you remember in the Phoenix Lights, they talked about the lights being see-through. Remember?
Yeah, right.
And so this is also a hollow light.
Well, when you kind of think about in a lot of television shows, since obviously this is because color TV and all that advancement and stuff, but when you think about a lot of the TV shows, when they show kind of that white light from a craft engulfing people on the ground, it is kind of, it's white, but you can see everybody within it, right?
Yeah.
It's not so blinding white that you can't see anything. You know?
Right.
You know, I wonder how much of that in TV is influenced by stories like this.
Interesting. Wonder.
So, the next thing they knew, they were standing on the bank.
So they had time loss.
Yep. And it goes on to say that the once glowing fire to be nothing but smoldering ashes.
Interesting. So they were able to physically see that time had passed.
Yeah. It says that the amount of wood and the size of the logs that were used, it should have taken like several hours for it to burn down. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant time gap.
Yeah, absolutely.
They kind of just packed up their gear and left and went about their respective careers and really didn't talk about it anymore. Until Jack started to have some nightmares.
Yeah, so Jack Weiner was the first to start having nightmares in this group, not a Charles. But in these dreams, he saw beings with long necks and large heads. He saw the beings examining his arm while Jim, Chuck, and Charlie sat on a nearby bench, not able to intervene. The beings had large metallic glowing eyes with no lids, and their hands were insect-like with four fingers. The other three men were experiencing very similar dreams, with short mental clips of that awful night on the lake. In 1988, out of curiosity, Jim Weiner attended a UFO conference hosted by Raymond Fowler.
Yeah, so Weiner met Fowler afterwards and kind of related his strange encounter. The investigator was excited about Jim's story, especially the fact that it was a multiple witness occurrence. Fowler suggested to them that he and the others undergo regressive hypnosis.
Right, just like the Stanford Three.
So one real callback here I want to make note of is, again, that kind of common thread around this kind of the description of the aliens, I think, meets the description of the Greys.
Yeah. The large heads, the skinny necks, the long insect-like fingers.
Fingers, right. Mm-hmm. So what's very interesting is, and I'll make a callback to the Fire in the Sky movie. If I don't know, again, this is where it comes in handy to have a photographic memory. But there's a scene in the movie where the guy gets loose from his captors and he's mm-hmm. like wandering around the ship, and he comes across spacesuits that look like the Greys. So the aliens are not actually designed, or they're not built that way, anatomically that way. They're just the spacesuits that they're wearing make them look that way. So it's just, again, interesting.
That's just how we perceive it as an actual person, much like if they ran into us in space, they would see this square head with a round bubble.
Right.
You know?
Or if you think about it from a, if in fact this is kind of an experimental type thing where they're doing experiments on us to try to understand whatever, they're likely going to wear some type of a protective
like
gear.
Like a hazmat suit.
Hazmat suit. I mean, think about it. If you encountered something that you'd never seen before in a hazmat suit, what would that look like to you?
Yeah. Creepy.
So.
Or like a gas mask and stuff.
So. But so after the, so they went ahead and did the regressive hypnosis. And they had a couple things. So the it was revealed that all four men had been abducted. They had been subjected to humiliating physical examinations.
That's a probe, people.
Including the taking of skin and fluid samples.
Yep. That's something that Fire in the Sky definitely hit on, was that sexual experimentation.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, you know.
Well, and it kind of gets back to my thing about, hybrids and...
Yeah.
I mean, So, I mean, we can grow life in a lab, so why wouldn't aliens be able to? Mm-hmm. So, then it goes on to say that the men's descriptions of the aliens was consistent. And being that they were artists, they were able to make detailed sketches of the entities.
Oh,
the
I
craft,
didn't even think about that.
And the examining instruments. And I went ahead and underlined this, because, again, I think this is kind of a common theme that I hear a lot, is that Chuck added that the aliens' test area was similar to a vet's office with a silvery table. And, you hear about that kind of a lot. It's just like kind of that platform-type metallic table that everything seems to happen on.
Interesting.
And again, when you think about it from a... scientists doing an investigation or something or a test, typically we ourselves use metal tables because it's a sterile environment. And so, again, it kind of gets back to what is the driving purpose behind the abductions and the test being done, and could it be some kind of an experimentation?
Interesting. He also related a strange fact where he said that he had much difficulty in focusing on the aliens, and that when he tried, he could not put an exact image to them. And he compared it to trying to tune in a fuzzy radio station, which is something I've heard before.
Well, I made a note here that in my dream that I talked about, not the two for Creepy Ketchup, but the one from before, I couldn't...
You couldn't focus on the black figure.
It was just kind of a black figure that was standing there, but I couldn't see any details about it.
A lot of that, if you've listened back to Brad's experiences with the men in his room and stuff, he had trouble focusing on their faces. I mean, even with night hags, like, it's most of the time all you can see are eyes, you know, in this black figure. Like,
but, and, you know, so part of that is you know, the it begs the question, is it your mind's inability to process what you're seeing? Or could it be some sort of memory manipulation that's occurring?
Right.
So that, indeed, you can't focus on what you're seeing because the memory has been altered.
Right.
So after the psychiatric examinations that were underdone as part of this, all four men were deemed to be mentally stable, and they passed lie detector tests. So, you know, no intent to defraud or or lie. I mean, so yeah, I mean it's really interesting. I watched this thing that William Shatner hosted, where they interviewed alien abductees.
Oh, I would love to see that.
It wasn't William Shatner. It was the guy, the new, the reboot of Star Trek. The guy who played Spock, Zachary Quinto.
Oh, Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he did a thing. And I guess it was something that Leonard Nimoy had done back in the 70s. It was the same type show.
Oh, yeah. I think I just ran across the Leonard Nimoy one on Amazon Prime the other day.
But so it was really interesting because here it is, Zachary Quinto played Spock.
So now we need the dude from Discovery to pick up the slack here.
But so they did an interview with an alien, a gentleman who claimed to be abducted by aliens. And they asked him if he would be willing to do a lie detector test. And he said, oh, yeah, I've got nothing to hide. So they did a lie detector test, and the lie detector test found that he was lying. But he believed his story so much to the point that he couldn't conceive that it would find that he was lying, but yet the lie detector test found that. So, you know, there's some back and forth discussion around whether or not the validity of lie detector tests. But, yeah, I mean, it's... It's really interesting here that they included that they did pass the lie detector test for this particular scenario. So most of this detail can be found in there's actually a book called The Allagash, The Event, written by B.J. Booth. And if you want to know more information about what we talked about here, that's a good source. But I do want to go into... There's some detail here, what they call the aftermath, and so this is kind of an individual's explanation or recounting of their experience going through with these four in the process of documenting for the book.
Right.
So first of all, there's an individual here that did the. Regressive hypnosis, and his name is Anthony
Constantino.
Constantino. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that how you pronounce that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was going to say Constantine. I don't know. So, yeah. But, and what's really interesting is you know, that individual was asked, do you believe them?
So, yeah, that's pretty much what they always ask all of the,
right.
the hypnosis people.
And I was just kind of go ahead and, you know, I've got this kind of highlighted towards the end, but the big thing is that he says, you know, do you believe them? He said he paused, he rubbed his chin as if weighing the gravity of this question. He looks up and nods solemnly. I do, he says. After working with those guys, I was scared. I still am. I think it's true. I think they were being tagged the way we tag and study sharks and bears and then release them. The men were highly indignant that they were taking aboard, and these things were done to them without their permission. So, think about that—the whole tagging thing.
Ugh.
I mean, and it stands—you know—you makes you wonder. Again, with the kind of string of abductions that happened over a period of time, the comment that we made around not being able to. Really recall the last time you heard about a big abduction in the media. When we tag things in the open ocean, we do it for a period of time, and then we watch their migration or we watch their movement. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, are we at a lull in the abductions until we whoever's doing the study and comes up with enough data to be able to either A, do some more tagging, or B, retrieve the tags.
Right.
So, but yeah, so one of the things that was called out here was that they were actually on the Joan Rivers show, which I tried looking up the date. I did find the episode. It's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. But I tried looking up the date of when that aired, and I really can't tell you. I can tell you that based on the clothing and the scene and the fact that it was dubbed over from VHS, it was probably back in the 80s or 90s.
Oh, it had it. Well, Joan Rivers was like early 80s.
Yeah, so. But, again, it's on YouTube if you want to go out there and watch the interview. It's pretty interesting. They were they received national attention. Like I said, there was a book that was written by Raymond Fowler.
Who's the guy that he met, Jim met, at that UFO convention. Raymond's from MUFON.
Yeah.
Which we talk about a lot.
Yeah.
And so I didn't realize that at first, but yeah, he's from the Mutual UFO Network. And so I didn't realize that he's the one that wrote that first book. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, and he was the one that Weiner met at the mm-hmm. at the convention that kind of started this whole, I guess, path
this
of
whole kit and caboodle
of finding out what the truth was. But it goes on to say that those who are familiar with this case know that the full story, with all its mysterious and harrowing details, wasn't revealed until Anthony Constantino, whatever you said a while ago, of Beverly, mm-hmm. placed the four men under hypnosis and revealed events that had been pushed into their own consciousness.
It's interesting because Constantino came out and said that it was the most intense experience that he had ever had as a hypnotist, which you got to imagine you're dealing with people that have dealt with trauma, with abuse, yeah. with murder, with all sorts of stuff, yet this alien abduction case is the most intense experience he'd ever witnessed.
Well, yeah, I mean, because, you know, he said that he spent 12 hours doing the hypnosis, 3 hours with each of the four men. That's a lot of time to mm-hmm. immerse oneself in the experience. But we know about the Eagle Lake and Maine. They went fishing for the evening. It goes on to provide that there was that colored light that was hovering. Now, this actually gives some detail that it was soundless. Again, so that's kind of note back to the Phoenix Lights, the soundless, 200 to 300 feet above the southeastern rim of the cove. it's kind of, I don't know, funny, but it says when he blinked his flashlight at the object, maybe that was a bad idea.
Yeah, of course he signaled it. I mean, this thing may not have seen them.
Right. I mean, it probably saw like the fire.
The fire. They were probably already attracted to the fire.
Right. But I mean, here you are, basically. You know, a hole on the water.
Maybe, right, they're out there looking for deer and bear, tagging.
That makes sense, right? This goes on to say, kind of an explanation of the beam of light. It was cone-shaped. So a cone-shape implies it was from a single source, right?
Right.
It wasn't illuminated from multiple different lights around the craft. It was a single source of light. And that the object struck the water and began following the canoe.
So it followed like a spotlight.
So, I mean, imagine, they're paddling as hard as they can towards the shore, and they can't get out of this light, mm-hmm. and this light is just following them as they go. But the beam engulfed them, and the next thing they remembered, they were in the canoe near the shore of the lake, watching the UFO ascend and disappear.
Interesting. So they see it. They're paddling. They wake up. They see it. Say goodbye.
Yeah.
Whew, that's got to be horrifying.
Well, I mean, from a UFO perspective, why couldn't you just, quietly get out, put your pants on?
Yeah.
You know, leave the room without letting anybody know. You know, why do you have to drop them off on the shore and say, bye, guys? It's nice talking to you guys.
Thanks. Bye.
But yeah, it goes on to echo that the bonfire was nothing but embers that was built with heavy logs that should have lasted for hours.
It's kind of cool that they had that, because a lot of times when it's dark like that, if you have a watch on, it'll freeze up and be at the time you left,
yeah.
so you don't know how much time has passed. But this gives a physical indicator of time.
Yeah. Well, and I know I've had, my dad has built some pretty big fires in the fireplace before. And he'll go and stoke it and move logs around and stuff like that. But, I mean,
he's a log mover.
But it does take a long time.
It does.
For a fire to burn down.
Especially a big one. However, though, I will continue on to say that it was years later before the four men explored that missing period of time, which is strange to me. I would have been on that immediately. I get mad when I go into Walmart thinking it's been 15 minutes and it's been 2 hours because the time wizard's got you. But when Jim Weiner suffered temporolimbic epilepsy, his doctors asked him to report any unusual experiences that might be symptomatic. And Weiner described his UFO experience and various phenomena that had happened to him and his camping buddies since then. His doctors suggested he contact a UFO researcher. And this is where Anthony Constantino comes in, a professional hypnotist from Beverly who also worked as an English teacher at a high school. Constantino had hypnotized Ray Fowler in 1988, helping him to remember the details of Fowler's own alleged abduction in Danvers, which we should totally find that and cover that. Fowler was leading the investigation of the Allagash abductions for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and he wanted Constantino to hypnotize each of them separately. And, of course, all four men, participated. We know that. Constantino says it's natural. They wanted to know if something had happened to them, especially if it was something traumatic. They wanted to know for sure. So in 1989, in the dark den of Constantino's Beverly home, each of the four men separately recounted a tale of being beamed aboard the UFO that night on Eagle Lake. So it looks like then our date for the Joan Rivers show would have been 89-90.
Yeah.
More than likely.
But think about it. So this is all coming to light in 89. So this is now 13 years.
Yeah. So it's years later.
So under hypnosis, they described the diffusely lit, sterile interior of the spacecraft, the spindly fingered, big eyed, bald headed aliens that Whiteley Strieber popularized with his nonfiction book Communion.
I love Communion. Have you ever seen the movie?
I have not.
Well, I have the book as well. The book is very different, but the movie has Christopher Walken in it, and he does one of his famous dance scenes on this UFO ship because this alien kind of gets him to do it. It's really interesting while he's abducted, because they're really trying to get him. They're exploring different things about the humans, and
yep.
it's crazy.
Oh.
But yeah, Communion is based off of another true story. It's something I would love to cover down the road.
Well, I'll have to make sure to watch that at like 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday.
Yes.
So Constantino, I'm just going to give up on trying to pronounce that name.
Just call him Anthony.
Says Fowler was cool and professional as he observed the 12 hours of hypnosis sessions. But Anthony admits that at times he had difficulty repressing his own astonishment.
God. So his professionalism, he couldn't even keep together.
Yeah.
Whew.
He says, I'm the one who kept making faces at Ray like, I can't believe this. I can't believe what was done to these guys.
This is like Venkman looking at Ray as well.
Exactly. So again, this article kind of finishes out with just, again, echoing that, Anthony believed what these guys were saying. I would love, and maybe it's in the book, but I would love to get a hold of the transcript from the hypnosis sessions. I don't even know if it's out there or not, but man, I would, maybe we can do some research and see if we can find that.
We can share that online.
If somebody is listening and happens to know where that might be located, maybe they can provide it. But, that would be really something to read if that's available. So,
So here's what's cool about this is, so not only are there various documentaries and stuff, but it was covered on Unsolved Mysteries, which is always super cool, which all of the Unsolved Mysteries are available on Amazon Prime now, so I'm going to be looking for that specific episode, as well as a TV program called Abducted by UFOs. So that's very, very interesting.
I wonder what that TV show is about.
I don't know. I do not know. From something that I found, too, is that Charles Rack, okay, I believe that one's Charlie, right? Charlie has actually changed his story over time. The other three still stand by it, but Charlie now calls it a bit of brilliant storytelling. According to him, he had an interview with the St. John Valley Times where he said he saw strange lights during the camping trip, but the abduction part of the story was a total fabrication, and he went along with the narrative for financial gain.
Yeah, this This to me says, I can't deal with the pressure that I'm getting from my friends and family for being honest about this story, so I'm going to say it was a hoax.
Yep. And, of course, the other three members... The other three members of the group stand by the abduction story. According to Jim Weiner, Jack, Charlie, and I, after all these years, are still in agreement with the Eagle Lake event as we three remember it. We also accept the results of the hypnotic regression sessions and subsequent polygraph tests as supportive of an abduction scenario. Jesus. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's... Yeah. I mean, that's just so, you know, and I wonder how now we're getting to, let's see, it's 30, right? 30 years, is it? No, yeah. more than that, 40.
Yeah, almost, it'd be 43 years.
Yeah. I wonder if it's still vivid in their minds, you know, because a lot of that kind of stuff sticks
with
you.
If they're even still alive, but, I mean, it's got to be. I can't imagine that it wouldn't be. I mean, like I said, it had to be. Frightening, but I mean, like I said, Rack is still coming out and saying that they did it for money, and I'm really sick of this because it has that whole idea is the biggest things that skeptics say.
Yeah.
But and I will say this, like I said during the Amityville episode, is who in their right mind is going to put themselves and their family and their friends through all of this garbage and this horrible just abuse or whatnot for the slight possibility
of making
of
some
fame.
Money. Yeah.
And if we look into this, I feel like that this story didn't even get popularized until the late 80s.
Right.
So it's like it's not even like they were like right afterwards,
right.
Hey, let's go tell people this, you know, because here we are 12 years later before anything even happens with it because they had been going through mental breaks.
Well, I mean, and if you've kind of pieced together the, you know, the fact that this guy had medical conditions, I'd imagine that it went something like this. You know, he had that medical condition. What was it called? The lymphomic something or other.
Olympic.
Yeah. I don't want to, because it's probably really serious conditions. I don't want to necessarily make temporo limbic epilepsy.
Right.
Yeah, so he has that. He goes to see a doctor. Doctor says, hey, have you ever had a traumatic experience? Unusual experience. He says, oh, yeah, me and my buddies were abducted by aliens. Now imagine, you know, first of all, his doctor's probably like, yeah, right, no, really, what happened? And he's like, no, really, you know. So then they direct him to the UFO researcher. That's when he probably goes to a convention, meets Fowler, and then everything kicks off.
Kicks off from there.
So I mean, That's a long time to hold on. I mean, I get it. They probably told their friends and family, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe that all this happened. But again, like you say, that's 13 years later. That's a long time to hold on to something for fame and fortune.
Yeah. So in this interview that I also found here on fiddleheadfocus.com, it really gets into Charlie's skepticism. He says that on the Wednesday before, the group witnessed an unidentified flying object during their canoe trip, both on the night of the alleged abductions, as well as two nights before on another lake called Chamberlain Lake. So we're actually seeing two nights here. And he still stands by that they saw this. So he's not saying that it was a helicopter. He is legit saying they saw a UFO. He said that it was the most vivid sighting he had seen. He had an uncomfortable feeling of being stared at. He turned around and saw a very, very bright globe of light in the sky. He described it as changing color from white to red to green in a liquid kind of melding motion.
Again, the liquidity.
Mm-hmm. And then he went on to say that the group reported the experience the next day to a ranger on duty, who Rack said quickly dismissed the sighting, attributing the lights as coming from a grand opening at a hardware store in the town of Millinocket. Rack said the guy said what we saw were these guys operating a searchlight in the back of a pickup truck, that there was no But there was no way that this could have been any hardware store grand opening at 9 o'clock at night coming from 75 miles away.
No, unless you have just an amazing searchlight. I mean,
right.
I mean, I've seen grand openings from, let's say, 30 miles away. You can usually see the searchlights sweep the sky. But it's like a really faded light. It's not like there's a light above you shining down.
Yeah, it very much dissipates. Yeah. Charlie also went on to say that the men never once discussed the possibility of having been abducted by aliens until years later after Jim Weiner suffered a traumatic fall and began to experience seizures. Charlie says after suffering this fall, he started having these visions of humanoid beings levitating above his bed, poking him with needles, and he attributed those to the event. Jim Weiner, of course, eventually shared his visions, like we talked about, and the other ones seemed to recall the same thing. They said the aliens performed what they perceived to be medical examinations on the men. But, I mean, Charlie Rack wants nothing to do with this.
Well, again, I think it's just his own coping mechanism for not wanting to deal with it or not wanting to have the pressure of it anymore. unfortunately, like you say, I mean, it gives skeptics something to latch onto and say, well, here's the one guy who said all this in the beginning, and now he's changing his story.
Well, and it's interesting because in the Amityville story, the lawyer of, the murderer that was there, DeFeo, that lawyer was the one that approached Lutz about doing this and, you know, we should, you know, get a book deal and yada, yada, yada. So immediately, that means everything he said was fake.
Right.
Well, what happens here is Rack is also saying that they were compelled by Fowler to stay together, saying that it was Fowler that pushed them, that this could make them millions of dollars. And Rack even said, in the end, we made very little. And once again, I'm like, Fowler was the one that was like, we need to get each of these guys separate and do hypnosis.
Well, and I mean, MUFON's a pretty respected organization out there. And Fowler worked for MUFON at the time when he started all this. So I just can't imagine that he would have went through all of this to... for the purpose of trying to make money.
Yeah, he said eventually him and the others had a falling out because of it, after which is when he started telling people that the abductions never took place. He wanted to say that it's not an outright hoax. He says, I don't call it a hoax, I just call it brilliant storytelling. It's not the truth, but I have to admire the storytelling ability of my old friends. Rack also challenges what many believers of the abductions consider a key element of the case, which is the lost time the men allegedly experienced. The men all claimed, of course, that when they set out fishing, that they had a huge fire burning at the campsite, and that when they came back, it was gone. Rack now dismisses this suggestion as complete, well, we'll call it manure. He says, it certainly was a big fire. I agree with that. Those logs were maybe 3 inches. Some of them could have been almost 3.5 inches. That's the biggest they could have been. And most of them were smaller. And as such, in the condition, those pieces of wood would have burned off very quickly. But Foltz, in a telephone conversation from his Massachusetts home, claimed very differently. Of course, he said, some of the wood we put on there was the diameter of my leg. I would say at least a good 10 inches in diameter, easy.
Hmm.
So, I mean, they're still fighting back
and forth. Competing
stories,
right.
Like, this article came out in 2016, and so this guy contacted both of them. So at least as of 2016, these two were still alive. Another thing, though, and of course, and I was waiting for this, is Charlie Rack also said that during the interview that he and the other members of the group had also been using recreational drugs on the night of the alleged abduction. Rack says, I remember Jack brought some Afghan temple ball with him to share with the rest of us. Yeah, we were definitely stoned out of our minds when we went out on the lake before we got that sighting.
Well, then obviously it must be a hoax, right?
Yeah, because, you know, they're shared delusion.
Right.
Which, you know, happens. According to Rack, he felt conflicted when others asked him whether the group had been under the influence of drugs or alcohol on the night of the encounters. He said, I remember being on Joan Rivers' show, and Joan was asking, were you guys drinking or taking drugs? Fortunately, I was sitting the farthest from her, but Jim was right next to her, and he had to field that question, and he lied. And that way, I didn't have to lie.
Hmm.
Foltz denies any drug use among the Allagash Four during the outing. Foltz has said, no, we bought an 8-pack of beer from Millinocket when we bought all of our supplies for the canoe trip. We each had one beer at Telos Landing the very first night, and we each had one beer at Fort Kent the last day of our canoe trip. We carried those 8 bottles in, and we carried those 8 bottles back out.
I mean, just because, even if they did, you know, smoke a little weed, I mean, there's nothing, I mean, a lot of experiences have been heightened because of, you know, hallucinogenic
sure.
type
I
drug.
Sure, I mean, look at MK Ultra. I mean, that whole thing is, it's insane to think about.
Well, I mean, you think about a lot of the Native American tribes, you know.
Right.
That was how they connected with their gods was, you know, smoke a little peyote. And
yep.
So, yeah, put you on a higher plane.
Yeah. So the other guys describe Rack as a man with a violent temper. So here's the other side, right? So they said that he's been banned from a ton of UFO conventions, which he shouldn't be going anyways if he's saying it,
right,
it's not
all,
real.
Yeah.
But Foltz said, we definitely steer clear of him because this guy is a loose cannon and is a mental disaster area. Like, they call him a whole mental disaster area. And Jim, of course, Weiner, dismisses all of the new claims. He says, I personally believe that Mr. Rack's self-aggrandizing rationalizations and disparaging accusations are simply the rantings of an angry and resentful individual on whom his former friends have turned their backs on.
Huh. We almost have to wonder if this is a reattempt to bring attention to the story again for the purpose of, so if things have kind of died down over the years,
mm-hmm.
now I'm gonna go and reverse my story. This is gonna
well,
bring attention,
I mean,
back
if
to
you
things.
Look at 2016, it would have been 30 years
yep.
later, so they I'm sure the news was like, hey, what can we find
right.
newsworthy. But it's interesting because a follower was originally supposed to be fully interviewed for this story, but the second he found out that Chuck Rack was going to be involved, he dropped. He didn't want anything to do with Chuck, so most of the stuff that they got was from an email. Follower wrote an email that said, Charlie Rack did not have very detailed recall of the abduction under hypnosis. He is the type of person who needs to be in control. He was not happy not being able to have a detailed recall of the abduction like we did. Thus, several years after the investigation, he claimed that no one was abducted.
So he sat on the bench in the alien ship the whole time.
Right. He was the guy on the bench that talked about, and they probably didn't
yeah.
have the same situations. Things happen.
The same experience, yep. And so because he didn't have as full of an experience to talk about, he's felt slighted. And this is kind of starting to fit together a little bit.
Yeah, and Jim Weiner even goes on to say that after the Joan Rivers interview, it was Rack that tried to convince the men of new ways to capitalize on the case. Mm-hmm. So,
this definitely feels like a I wasn't a key player, so now I'm going to change my story. That'll make me a key player. Maybe I can get some money out of this.
Yeah. So he goes on in the email. Weiner says, Charlie Foltz and I were visiting Jack and his wife, Mary, at their home in Vermont. One morning, Mr. Rack arrived at the house and declared that he had a plan to make $1 million on our case. His proposal was that all four of them refute the professional handling of the case by Raymond Fowler, Tony Constantino, and MUFON, thereby creating controversy, which was, in Mr. Rack's mind, exactly what the media and the public crave and pay for. In response to his proposal, Jack, Charlie, and Jim all voiced their disgust with his ethics and his proposal and announced their unanimous decision to have no further interaction with him regarding future Allagash projects. Unfortunately, they later forgave his inebriated indiscretion and appeared together on a couple of TV projects and UFO conferences, but it was glaringly clear to Jack, Charlie, and Jim that Mr. Rack's behavior was becoming increasingly pathological. And so that right there says he wanted to separate himself from the pack as a way to make money on
yeah.
the other side of things
yeah.
to be the refuter, the skeptic.
Right. Like you say, like it says in the article, create some controversy.
Mm-hmm. Because you got to imagine, those three guys will get invited to a show and be paid three ways, where he will come on and be paid one way.
Right.
Oh, lordy, man.
All about those greenbacks.
Yep. Man, this is crazy. But yeah, One more thing I want to say is that Rack never disputed Weiner's description of the events following that the alleged abductions, and claims that it freed him to finally share the truth about everything that evening. He said, when I was kicked out of the group, I felt a great release. I was at liberty to finally tell the truth. I don't have any Sterling character to preserve.
Hmm. So what he's saying is that his soul is available for the highest bidder.
It is. He also doesn't dispute alien abductions. He thinks they are possible. He says he's open-minded about it. It just didn't happen to us. It's according to him. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, that's the Allagash abductions, yeah. Man, both from a skeptic side, which turns out to be someone from that, as
right.
well as, you know, everything else. I don't know. I mean, you know, I know I'm one of those people that, hey, I want to believe. Don't get me wrong. I know I'm bad about that. But, like, this, I don't know. If you look at, you know, some other cases that are out there, it fits that. And it was, you know, information wasn't as widespread as it is now.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, that when you start to actually go back and look at the accounts from various periods of time over the last, you know, 30 or 50 years, they all seem to share similar or common themes, like the table, the description of the aliens, the description of how the abduction occurred, the description of time loss.
Yep.
And at that time, when the earlier ones occurred, you're right. I mean, there wasn't widespread media that really talked about this kind of thing. I mean, now, granted, somebody probably could have gone to the National Enquirer or something
sure.
like that, and somebody might have been standing in line at the grocery store and read the story. But it's more likely, I think, that those commonalities that exist between stories are there because these events are actually occurring.
That's right. And speaking of stories, let's move on. We got to get to our listener story. Like we said, we have Stephen Stanek's mother. Stephen was a guest 2 weeks ago, and his mother sent in a story. So here is her listener story.
Hello, my name is Maria Stafford. I am Stephen Stanek's mother, and I enjoyed listening to the podcast with him on it. I had no idea that my son was so much deeper into the paranormal than I am. It is true about the beautiful ghost woman that is at his dad's house. I've seen her. She had a blue dress and blonde hair, and she would come in the living room and swing the light back and forth. Also at that house, you would see shadows going across the window that Stephen talked about. It would freak me out, and I swear, they've been following me for quite some time. I don't know if they're still at my ex-husband's house or not anymore. I go over there occasionally and feed the animals during the day, and I don't like being in that house at night. It's so creepy. My house was just up two streets from my ex's to keep the kids close to their dad and their schools. We had a shadow man in my house that I saw many times. It is possible that it could have been from the couple there before us. You see, the husband there died, so the wife wanted to move out ASAP. Lucky me, right? No, not lucky. The shadow man would move our shoes, rock the rocking chair, and once he even got on top of me when I was putting my daughter down for bed. I was horrified. I felt a heavy weight on me. I was so scared. I opened my eyes and everything was blackness. I couldn't see the glow and the dark stickers on the wall or the light from the window or even the door to the hallway. I mean, nothing, just darkness. I yelled for it to get off me and to go back to where it came from, and I felt it leave. I am good now. I even saged that house many times, but the shadow man seems to have relocated to my new husband's house. He won't let me sage his home because he is chemically sensitive because of fighting for our country in Vietnam. And things have escalated since I moved in with him. I am now fighting what I believe are demons every day. I lay in bed trying to sleep, and I get tapped on my legs or shoved, and they are even making my husband go crazy. I have to fight them every day. So I have a mantra that I use when they attack us. It is, "Demons, go back to where you came from in the name of Jesus Christ." Anyway, the driving encounter that Stephen spoke about on the last episode is true. Stephen was passing, but there was a lot of traffic in front of us, and behind us, No cars going towards the other way, but there were cars going towards 3 points, so I let my son attempt to pass the slow-moving vehicle in front of us. All of a sudden, a car turns off onto the highway, and this car appears out of nowhere that turned. I felt the car should have seen us, but it came right for us, and we should have died. There was not enough time or space to pass the car and my gutless Bronco, too, so I started yelling, "Slow down! Get back in place!" I don't remember putting my foot on any pedal like Steven said, because that's an impossible thing to do. But it was right then that Steven slowed down, and I grabbed the steering wheel and turned it hard right. We went right back behind the car we were trying to pass, and straight off the road. And we came to a complete stop. And when we got out of the car, there wasn't a car in sight in either direction. It was a freaky feeling, to say the least. Were we being tested? I don't know. But I feel we passed the test because we lived, and that's all that mattered to me. But if I did push on those brakes, that was a miracle. Anyway, when it was all over, we saw nothing. I thought to myself, what happened to all the traffic that was there? The highway is always busy, and there was nothing for miles either way. Well, I have no clue what truly happened that night, but one thing I know is that my family is still alive to tell the tale.
Okay, wow. Yeah. Steven, your mom's got some dibs, man. That was creepy. I like that she refuted a lot of, not refuted, the opposite of that.
Confirmed
a lot of Steven's stories. I thought that was really cool.
It's really interesting, the shadow man that appears to be almost attached to that family.
Yeah.
That followed her.
Followed her, yeah. And in a way followed Steven, so... Yeah. Very interesting. But yeah, please, guys, if you're listening, send your listener stories to us to fearscapepodcast@gmail.com. We will take those stories and we will read them on air, or you can send us a voice recording. Just let us know what you'd like to do. Either way, we want those stories. But we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
It's time to roll, ladies and germs. We got to get rolling. But thank you so much for listening here on 100.9 FM WCHQ, as well as the Destination Nation Network at destinationcomics.com/DNN. We are live every 9 p.m. Sundays at 9 p.m. And then the podcast drops every Wednesday following that. So be on the lookout for all of those. And on that, we got to get out of here, man.
Yeah, got to go.
We got to get out before it gets dark and we see these lights. But thank you guys for tuning in. My name is Stefan, and I will catch you on the flip side.
Yeah, this has been Josh. The truth is out there.
And remember, folks, hold those blankets extra tight. Good night, everybody.
Good night.